now in session. Judges Ross, Bjorkman, and Reyes, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to this April 19, 2023 panel of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have three cases on our oral calendar today. The first case is Heidi Heller on behalf of minor children and against Bo Thomas Giesler. Correct me if I'm mispronouncing the name. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument and an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Please be mindful of the timing restrictions. They're indicated in the light and clock in the podium, which, by the way, there's a button in front. You can raise or lower the platform so the microphone is elevated to match your height for your convenience. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument because we do keep an audio recording of the proceeding. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Tom Kiesel. I'm the attorney for appellant Bo Giesler. I start by asking, what is the most important thing to us in our lives besides our children? The answer to that is nothing, and the same applies to Mr. Giesler. Because of that, I stand before you angry, embarrassed, and worried. I'm angry because of the judicial process used to unfairly bar Mr. Giesler from his daughters for the last year, which is ongoing, not to mention branding him as a sex offender of his own child. Before a trial like this, I talk to clients and I explain the process. A lot of times clients think that you can submit letters to the court or have people give statements out of court. And I talk to him about this is a real trial with a real judge, real rules of evidence. Witnesses have to testify directly from the witness stand under oath and subject to cross-examination. I mean, the rules themselves say so, and this court, in a published opinion, has affirmed that.
Can I take you directly to one of the issues that you raised, just so I can understand?
Certainly.
It seems as if your challenge, your evidentiary challenge regarding the testimony being taken by the children, testimony taken of the children by the district court in the chamber, is sort of bifurcated. There's a locational challenge and a method of cross-examination challenge. Is that a fair characterization of the argument?
Yes.
As to location, what rule or other, whether rule of evidence or other procedural rule, prohibits the taking of testimony of a child witness in chambers? Or in other words, what makes that proceeding outside the courtroom if the audio is heard in the courtroom and there's a court reporter transcribing the testimony?
Well, I mean, it's blatantly 801 hearsay. It's an out-of-court statement. Chambers is not court, okay? Chambers does not have the attorneys. Chambers does not have the oath. Chambers has one person informally questioning another person.
But just so if I understand you correctly, so then, for example, all the proceedings that went on during COVID that were handled with the judge in chambers electronically, those are out of court statements under your understanding of the term court.
I'm not sure what COVID has to do with it. I mean, we did some proceedings remotely. In fact, the initial OFP in this case between Ms. Heller and Mr. Giesler, between those two parties, was done in a Zoom hearing.
Right, I brought that up not because of COVID, but because the hearing is done outside of the courtroom. It's a physical courtroom itself.
Right, that's a virtual courtroom, okay? But the witnesses were still under oath. They were still talking about things they witnessed directly.
Right, I'm trying to focus on the locational part before we get to the other part.
Sure.
So what is the case law that supports the idea that testimony taken in chambers, assuming all the other elements are met, and I know you have a dispute about those elements too, what's the basis for our agreement with you that the location makes all the communication under, assuming it's under oath and it's transcribed and recorded, hearsay.
There isn't any. It hasn't ever been done. We don't do things this way. We don't have a judge take a witness into chambers and question them as an advocate. That's what advocates, that's what lawyers are for. That's what we do. I mean, this judge fashioned herself as the referee, but she inserted herself in this case as a party, took over the role of questioning the petitioner.
Well, I'm gonna stop you there. I'm not certain that I agree with your characterization of what the district court did and how it saw its role. As I understand it, respondent had asked prior to the trial to not be required to bring the girls in to testify at all. Your client objected to that, understandably. And as I understand, there was a hearing at which the district court heard from both parties and fashioned this procedure under which the lawyers both had chance to submit written questions that the court would then ask. And the procedures, as I understand it, included being in chambers with the children, which happens in child protection cases with some regularity and other kinds of cases, and allowed the lawyers to be hearing in real time the testimony from these two girls and the court reporter to make the record for appeal purposes. Now, part of our problem is we don't have a transcript of that hearing during which this procedure was entered into, but I struggle to find that that wasn't an appropriate procedure. Why would that constitute abuse of discretion to handle it that way?
What's the basis for it? Why am I required to defer my job to a judge who did it very poorly? Very poorly. She didn't even establish what she needed to for the respondent's case, let alone my case.
You didn't submit questions, as I understand it. But so I'm not sure to criticize the questions when you chose not to submit written questions in advance of the thing. But again, why? I understand that there's not a case that says this is okay, but what is it about the court's broad discretion that was abused by the procedure the court selected here?
In a situation where we believe these children were coached to say what they were going to say by the respondent, why in the world would I give my cross-examination questions in advance so that they could go through that? I mean, it went right to the parties. Why would I do that? And why wouldn't I have a chance at spontaneous cross-examination? Sometimes you cross-examine a witness based on what they say from the stand, which differs from what they've said before. How do I have that chance if I'm barred from the room and not even allowed to object? I mean, I couldn't even speak to that judge and object to what she was doing.
The difficulty is, it seems as if your challenge is to the procedure, and that would be an abuse of discretion standard that we're considering whether the district court should have or shouldn't have applied this particular procedure. The district court determined that procedure in a hearing. We don't know what happened during that hearing. We don't know what arguments were made. We don't know what information the district court had before it, because neither party in this appeal provided a transcript of that proceeding. And am I correct about that? And if so, how would we determine whether the district court abused its discretion if we don't have insight into the basis on which the district court made that decision?
You have all of my written objections to it. The hearing wasn't much of a hearing. I mean, she just came out from chambers and said, this is my decision.
How do we know that?
Well, I mean, we don't have that transcript. I mean, we can get that transcript if that makes a difference, but
my question, it's not a point, how do we know if it makes a difference if it hasn't been provided to us by the party who has the burden on appeal to provide the relevant transcript and record?
I think you're going too far. I think the fact of the matter is that whatever basis she made for deciding what she decided, there is no precedent for it. None. Show me where a judge is allowed to do this. In the family court rules, there's a very specific procedure. She even violated that. But that goes to when you're questioning a child about their custodial preference. That is a subjective preference, not a fact issue. And I hope you understand the difference between the two. In this case, we were talking about disputed facts. What happened?
Hope you understand the rule that requires the party with the burden on appeal to present the relevant record for us to consider in an abuse of discretion challenge.
Well, if you want to get into how she made her decision. She didn't put anything on the record. I don't have a record to give you that outlines her analysis. I mean, she should have put it in writing. She should have made a written order. She didn't.
Was there an oral decision?
Yeah, she came out of chambers after reading the submissions, my brief. There was a letter that was submitted. It's in the record. You have that. Objecting to the procedure. She just came out and said, this is how we're doing it. And she reaffirmed that at the beginning of the trial transcript that you do have. She said, there won't be any cross-examination of the children. I objected again. The rules of evidence tell us that witnesses have to testify live, in person, from direct knowledge, under oath, and subject to cross-examination.
I have a question, counsel, on that. You have referred several times to the fact that a person has to testify under oath, but there are several instances in which a child doesn't have to take the oath. There's kind of that two-step process, as you are familiar, where they affirm that they're going to tell the truth, and that seems that occurred here, correct?
No.
That the district court affirmed you're going to tell the truth, right? You're going to say what the truth is, right?
Informally, yes.
So why isn't that sufficient when that is something, a procedure that's commonly used with children?
Yeah, it would have been fine if it had been done in the courtroom in front of the parties.
No, but I'm what I'm talking about is just in this particular setting.
Sure.
That part was, at least that part was taken care of, correct?
The formalities matter. And did these children know they were under oath? There's no indication that they knew that. They were told, hey, we're just going to have a little conversation. I'm like the referee, which referees
but
stay
that's,
partial.
That, but that happens in child protection cases on a regular basis, where with children, when they're testifying, whether it's in court or whether it's in chambers.
Yeah, I mean.
You are going to tell the truth, correct?
It wasn't asked in that fashion. It was asked, do you know the difference between a truth and a lie? And yeah, I mean, she covered
right,
that.
That's right. So,
she covered
so that.
That
was covered then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. But I mean, I think you're missing statute 595.03, which talks about witness competency in specifically child sex abuse cases. And these children were both of age and by this tortured process actually proved their competence to testify in court.
But there's nothing in the statute regarding the children's competence or the rule regarding children's competence that regards location. You seem to be merging the two, that if a child is competent, then the child has to give testimony in court and nowhere else. I don't think that's what the rule refers to.
I gave you a litany of cases where children as young as 3 years old testified in courtrooms.
That's not you're not addressing the issue I'm raising, which is whether the statute that you're citing to demonstrate competency requires the testimony of the competent child to occur in court. I'm wondering, that's the link I'm not sure I see as being
connected. You're asking me to prove a negative. There is no authority I can point to that.
I'm not asking you to prove a negative. I'm asking you, in the rule itself, does the rule itself pertain to location or does it pertain to competence?
The rules require testimony live in person in front of.
The rule that you're referring to as the basis for children testifying in court regards competence, I think, as I read the language. I'm wondering if there's language in the rule that you believe requires, in that particular rule, that requires testimony to occur in court as opposed, in the courtroom as opposed to in the court's chamber.
There's no specific language because it's presumed that this is going to be in front of the fact finder, not an investigator in a separate room away from the attorneys with no cross-examination.
Well, it wasn't an investigator, it was a judge. But actually, there's only less than 2 minutes left, and I just want to switch gears real quick. One of the issues with respect to an OFP, an order for protection, can issue upon a showing of either physical harm, bodily injury, or assault under Minnesota Statute 518, Subdivision 1. I'm sorry, 1 Subdivision 2A1. Physical harm can constitute by itself, domestic abuse, and that does not require any form of intent. I understand your argument to be that, you know, there's no showing of intent, but that goes to assault. But physical harm itself does not require, have an intent requirement. So why does it even matter?
What I absolutely disagree with you. So, okay, if I'm cooking in my kitchen and I have a pot of boiling water and I go to take it off the stove and I actually spill some on my child, does my significant other then get an order for protection against me because I inflicted physical harm? That's not the law.
Where in the statute does physical harm require intent?
Throughout it.
Assault does. I agree with you that assault has an intent requirement. Well, where does physical harm require intent?
You're now saying that accidental physical harm qualifies for an OFP, and that is not the law.
I'm not saying anything. I'm asking you, where in the statute does physical harm require intent?
Every single case of this court and the Supreme Court requires an assault with intent.
Right, I understand that. I agree with you. Assault does have an intent requirement, but there are three ways that somebody can engage in by showing a physical harm, bodily injury, or assault. And physical harm, my question to you again is, where is there an intent requirement for the physical harm under the statute?
Your time has expired, but you can quickly answer the question.
It's never been otherwise. If I'm playfully roughhousing with my child and they somehow get hurt, that is not grounds for an OFP, even though physical harm has been accidentally inflicted. We're not talking about accidents here. We're talking about intentional harm. That's what children need to be protected from, not accidents.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal time. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, Michael Boulette here on behalf of petitioner respondent Heidi Heller. Two issues before you an appeal today. First is a substantive question of whether the record below sustains the district court's findings of domestic abuse on three counts: sexual assault against the party's older daughter, biting the party's children, as well as the infliction of imminent fear of physical harm. Second issue, which absorbed the majority of oral argument for appellant, is process. Did the court have discretion to fashion the victim-centric process that it did in order to obtain the evidence and provide a balancing between mother's desire to proceed under the residual hearsay exception and father's desire for live, in-person cross-examination? Because the evidence more than sustains the domestic abuse perpetrated against these children, and because the district court had discretion under 518B to fashion a victim-centric process, we ask this court to affirm.
Can I take you to the first issue? The district court found in the checklist findings before the actual memorandum that respondent engaged in acts against the minor child, whose initial is O, that meet the definition of criminal sexual conduct. And in the district court's specific findings, the district court referred to touching her butt, boobs, pubic area. Am I correct that the only basis for the district court's finding, that particular finding, is the hearsay testimony?
I think you would be right, Your Honor, to say that the specific O's testimony was that her father rubbed his pubic area, his private area against her private area. That's the extent to which O's testimony tells us what happened. Mother's testimony gives us additional detail on that, which includes the boobs, butt, and pubic area. Correct.
You say additional detail. It's different detail.
Children
didn't testify to anything like this. I'll just be frank. That it looks as if the district court was relying upon out of court, as in not from the children directly, statements that were made by others, relayed to the court, allegedly made by the children. Was there any testimony that was provided to the district court for the truth of the matter asserted that supports the butt, boobs, and pubic area touching allegations.
I think you're correct, Your Honor, to say that the older daughter's testimony is that father rubbed his private parts into my private parts. Older daughter's testimony doesn't use the specific words boobs, butt, and private area. That, or pubic area, excuse me, that's mother's testimony.
Right. So am I correct that there is, well, was that testimony offered for the truth of the matter asserted, or was it supposed to simply be corroborative of the child's testimony to be admissible under the evidentiary rules?
My understanding of the district court's ruling is that it was admitting that testimony under 801 as a prior consistent statement by the minor child.
So not substantive?
I guess
prior,
my...
The purpose of a prior consistent statement is to corroborate testimony, not to offer, correct me if I'm wrong, as I understand the rule, not to provide substantive testimony that the district court or the fact finder is to accept for the truth of the matter asserted in it.
And Judge Ross, I don't have, I want to be cautious that I don't get too far out over my skis in respect to this question, but I believe that 801 prior consistent statements don't require, we removed the language in the rule that only allows them to be offered for kind of subsequent manufacture or subsequent untruthfulness, that it's whenever the prior consistent statement is useful to the fact finder in assessing the credibility of the witness.
Right, useful to assess credibility, not useful to establish the truth of the matter asserted in the prior statement. Correct?
I'm not certain I agree with you, Judge Ross. I believe that that the child's statements to mother are admissible both as prior consistent statements and under the residual hearsay exception. I understand and acknowledge...
Residual hearsay exception is a different matter that I would like to discuss with you.
Right. I do understand and acknowledge your point that the children's testimony is more general than mother's testimony on those same incidents.
Well, you say more general. I didn't see any testimony from the children that referred to butt and boobs.
I think the children talked about father's private areas touching their private areas, which I think the district court reasonably can infer what private area means.
Well, the district court put in quotes butt and boobs as if it was referring to testimony. And I don't think any of the children testified using those words. That came from hearsay testimony.
It came from mother's testimony,
Your
Honor. Correct. And the district court offers us a lot more in its memorandum to explain how it gets to these findings, including taking the children's statements alongside mother's statements, alongside the guardian and the child protection worker's statements that talk about the children's report as being clear and consistent and reliable.
Now, the residual hearsay rule allows for information to be included for the truth of the matter asserted, but only when there's no better source for that evidence. But the children were there testifying. Why wouldn't that be the better source that no one seemed to explore these particular allegations with the children?
I think, Your Honor, we have to be sensitive to what we're asking these children to do in a civil remedial proceeding. I respect counsel's reliance on criminal cases, but...
Well, it may be just a civil remedial proceeding, but you've got a district court making a public declaration that father engaged in criminal conduct, criminal sexual behavior.
Making a factual determination based on a preponderance of the evidence that it is more likely than not that father did, in fact, get into...
The point is it's significant. You're making it seem as if it was... Your characterization seemed as if you were rendering the proceeding less significant than it...
I don't mean to render the proceeding less significant. What I do mean to do is to draw a contrast with criminal proceedings in which there are distinct constitutional rights that we have to observe and that don't allow district courts the same flexibility they have to fashion a victim-centric process. The district court here had testimony from the oldest daughter that father climbed into bed and rubbed his private parts into hers repeatedly and after she asked him to stop. I respect your point, Your Honor, that the district court's quotation in its findings comes from mother's testimony, but the record as a whole is more than sufficient to support the finding as to what father did based on his eldest daughter's own testimony. I want to pause to make sure I have no further follow-up from you, Judge Ross.
You have the steering wheel at all times in the proceeding.
Fair enough.
Counsel, I just want to follow up quickly, and I appreciate that explanation, but I do want to, you know, the AOC case with respect to a residual exception, I'm not quite sure that really applies here because, as Judge Ross noted, in that case, the victim's we said there it didn't apply because the victims would have been more probative, and here the victims did testify. So does the residual exception even have any applicability here? And did the district court abuse its discretion, therefore, by making that determination?
So I think that, let me break your question down a little bit. From my perspective, the residual hearsay exception has the greatest level of import to remind us and to center us in the fact that district courts can and routinely do receive hearsay testimony from children in lieu of demanding that children testify in order for protection proceedings. While that may be less common in the criminal sphere, it is extremely common in the order for protection sphere. With respect to your specific question, Judge Reyes, I think I might bring us all back to the record to say that all of the district court's findings that father committed criminal sexual conduct against his eldest daughter, that he bit her and caused physical harm, and that he caused imminent physical harm, or imminent fear of harm to the youngest daughter, all have sufficient record support in the girl's own testimony. So even if this court determines that mother's testimony goes too far, it goes beyond, to Judge Ross's point, 801D comment, 801D statements that provide confirmation of the truth of what the girl said, we have enough information in the record to sustain the district court's findings on all three counts.
Well, how do we know that? The district court seemed to base its finding on the language that I indicated. And so, I mean, to say that, well, there's enough there, we don't know how the district court would have exercised its discretion if it decided that, well, the residual hearsay rule doesn't apply, that these details have never been provided for the truth of the matter asserted, in the evidentiary context for the truth of the matter asserted. So we don't know how the district court would have exercised its discretion.
I disagree, Judge Ross. I think the district court's memorandum gives us a lot of insight into its thinking, and you're right to point out that on the preprinted form, the district court is quoting mother's language. And the girls are not equivocal in their testimony to the district court, nor is their testimony ambiguous as to what their father did to them and when. The district, we're looking to see if there is sufficient evidence to sustain.
But they were never, I guess I'm troubled by the fact that if the district court's aware of these extraneous statements that reported by others, why the district court didn't inquire? If the district court's going to follow this process, why not allow for an opportunity to facilitate the girl's testimony on these specific points, especially if the district court's going to rely on those statements?
I think it's a fair point, Your Honor, and we would point out, again, that doesn't necessarily lead to reversible error. That appellant here has the burden of showing error in what the district court did. We don't have the transcript for the hearing in which this process was fashioned. We don't have objections to the way in which the district court chose to frame or ask the questions. And I think, importantly, appellant had the opportunity to offer the questions he wanted the district court to ask. And he said, no thanks. I don't want to participate in that process. I don't like the process, the victim-centric process that's been fashioned here.
Did the district court ever say that it was relying upon the residual hearsay rule as the basis for admitting the evidence?
It did not, Judge Ross. This is my reading of the varying bases on which these statements could come in from 801 to 807. But I would agree with you, the district court did not make that specific statement.
807 was the rule that you relied on, or that respondents' counsel relied on in the first instance in seeking to keep the girls out of the courthouse entirely.
Exactly right, Judge Bjorkman. And I'm not trying to take any liberties or mislead the court, but simply to say that this sort of 807 evidence is commonly the way we keep children out of family court, and respect the fact that without attempting to be dismissive, Judge Ross, that remedial proceedings are extremely important, and we recognize that because this is a different form of relief and a different type of proceeding, we prioritize keeping children out of the courtroom wherever we can. But to your point, Judge Bjorkman, the district court's not explicitly relying on the residual hearsay exception. The district court, to my mind, is extremely focused on what the children said to it, and many of its findings are grounded in the evidence the children provided.
Well, that's what makes it difficult. Had the district court not brought the children in and said, okay, I'm going to rely upon the residual hearsay rule and the statements that are already provided for the truth of the matter, Unfortunately, by bringing them into the courtroom, it seems to undermine one of the elements of the residual hearsay rule, which is that there's no better source of the evidence that we're seeking. We now have the better source; it's right here. But for some reason, that issue wasn't explored.
Those terms weren't explored, Judge. But I do think we have to respect the district court's discretion. I have enough when a young teen girl tells me that her father has crawled into bed with her at night and rubbed his private parts against her private parts, and that she cried and felt uncomfortable and asked him to stop, and he didn't, I do think there is discretion in the district court to say, that's enough. I've heard enough. I don't need to probe and poke and twist, particularly when I have a child who the guardian ad litem tells me is in therapy, needs psychotropic medications, is unstable, that a certain amount of discretion to the district court conducting that examination to say, his private parts pushed into my private parts repeatedly and against my will, doesn't require, nor would it be an abuse of discretion for the district court to fail to dig into, well, which private part was it? Was it your breast? Did he touch your pubic hair? Did he graze your vulva? That's a level of detail that could be extremely traumatizing to a child, and I think we can respect a district court's ability to say, his private parts into my private parts repeatedly and against my consent and against my will is enough to sustain a criminal sexual conduct finding in an order for protection proceeding.
There's only a minute left, and I want to ask you quickly about the cross-examination issue. Why isn't that an abuse of the district court's discretion by not allowing some type of cross-examination of the testimony by the children?
Contemporaneous cross-examination.
Excellent question, Judge Reyes. I'll try to do my best in 50 seconds. First, the removal of full hearing rights that this court observed in Oberg is extremely important. That this court previously decided that a full hearing, as 518B had previously been written, accorded respondents all kinds of rights, including the right to cross-examination. The legislature did not like that ruling and removed the word full, guaranteeing respondents only hearing rights. Now, this court observed that change in Oberg, but didn't tell us precisely what that distinction was intended to signify. However, in a non-precedential opinion in Danner, the court went on to say what it means is the ability to respond and essentially the ability to respond and to notice. It removes rights like the right to full cross-examination. So first, by removing full hearing from 518B, the legislature has told us cross-examination rights are not necessary. If I can take one more second.
Certainly respond to the question.
The second issue that is really important with respect to cross-examination is that appellant did have, not contemporaneous cross-examination, to your point, Judge Ross, but the ability to propound questions. And given that the children's statements, what the children were supposed to say, was already provided and noticed, there was that opportunity to provide cross-examination in advance to the district court. And so even to the extent that some amount of cross-examination was required, appellant had that opportunity and declined it by instead offering kind of generalized topic areas. My time's expired.
Although it's expired, I do want to ask you a little bit more on this issue. I'm trying to understand practically what would have been at all improper for the district court or difficult for the district court to say, okay, well, we're going to follow the process that I've included. But we've got lawyers in the courtroom. You're hearing live testimony. If you'd like to send over questions for cross-examination contemporaneous, so they're not provided in advance out of concern, since one of the parties has accused the other of coaching the children. I'm trying to understand why that would have been somehow inefficient or inappropriate.
It's a good question, Judge Ross. Candidly, my challenge is, as appellate counsel, I wasn't in the room during this hearing that we do not have a transcript for. So I don't know what alternatives appellant asked for, or if that possibility was even raised. Again, I think it's the danger of presuming error. The district court tried to fashion a process that would meet both parties' concerns. That process is within its discretion. I don't know if appellant has preserved any of those other issues by actually raising that issue for the district court so it could consider it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant. You have 5 minutes you may use for rebuttal.
So respondent obviously ignores ACO.
Please state your name as you commence each leg.
I'm sorry, Tom Kiesel for appellant. Respondent obviously ignores ACO versus Olson, where this court in a published opinion said the rules of evidence apply, okay? Rule 614 says the court may call witnesses and all parties are entitled to cross-examine witnesses thus called. Absolutely denied.
We don't know if it was absolutely denied. We don't know whether...
He refused to let us cross-examine anyone.
How do we know that if you haven't provided a transcript specifically with the suggestion that I raised, which is, well, you're concerned about them being out of court. If we knew that your client had asked, well, how about if you do this out of court, at least give us the opportunity to provide contemporaneous cross-examination questions to you. We don't know if that was requested.
It's in the record. It's in a letter I wrote to the judge before the hearing. It's also in the trial transcript. I've cited it in my brief. She says there will be no cross-examination of the children, period. She says that. That's directly in opposition to the rule that says I'm entitled to do it.
But and where
is the dispute here?
Rule 614 talks about witnesses called at the behest of the court. Are you suggesting that that's what the children were in this case?
They were called into chambers by the judge and questioned by the judge, but it wasn't trial testimony. Keep in mind.
They were called into court, I think, by your client, weren't they?
No.
I mean, well, no. As I understand, respondent didn't want to bring the girls into court, and your client did.
In the courtroom so they could be cross-examined on the witness stand as to the subject matter of their direct testimony. That didn't happen. Keep in mind, the respondent's record in this case, what was in the record here, not a shred of it, not a single thing is admissible evidence. It's all hearsay. The only...
Well, I respectfully disagree. I think the testimony from the children is not... How does that qualify as hearsay?
It's because out of court was, and uncross-examined.
Well, it's not out of court because they acknowledge that they would tell the truth.
Taking them into a separate room, though... Not in a courtroom where the formalities of telling the truth are observed.
And the taking formalities them into a separate courtroom, of a chambers is a fairly formal setting as well. And
chambers is not court.
And you have the both lawyers that are able to listen in on the testimony as well. So it's not like it's not like an in camera or completely sequestered from either one of the parties who had an opportunity to submit questions, including questions for cross-examine, knowing what they are going to testify to, especially if the information is alleged to have been coached.
I don't know what a child's going to testify to in a courtroom. I mean, just do this. Compare what the respondent wrote in her affidavit they would say and then what they actually said. One is this. It's extremely severe. What they actually said was extremely mild. How do I know what they're going to actually say? I don't. A lot of good cross-examination is done on the spur of the moment, spontaneously, when you've heard the testimony and it contradicts something they've said before. I can't submit questions weeks in advance to do that.
What remedy would you suggest as to the procedural error?
Well, put it this way. Even with the truncated summary process that the respondent got, I mean, she got what she wanted. Don't question my children at all. Just believe whatever they say. Believe what I'm telling you.
Well,
okay,
I don't
believe
think
all
she
the
got,
out-of-court
I
statements. Even with all of that.
Counsel, I don't think she got what she wanted because she didn't want them to testify at all.
Right, but she got them shielded from cross-examination, didn't she?
But she didn't want them to testify at all. It seems like the district court came up with, heard your arguments and heard mother's arguments and said, okay, I'm not going to give either one of you exactly what you want, but here's a compromise solution I'm going to come up with to provide the testimony from the children so I can make a determination as to credibility. It's better than residual, having it, residual and relying on hearsay. So case law has acknowledged that it is better to hear the testimony rather than having to rely on a residual. But otherwise, mother would have been able to rely on all of the hearsay under the residual hearsay exception then.
The trial court's process directly violated your court's teachings in ACO versus Olson. The rules of evidence apply. She didn't apply them. She did not apply them. That's why I'm embarrassed. I mean, why are we afraid of trials? Why are we afraid of cross-examination? I mean, I can fashion questions spontaneously that will be probing and yet delicate. I can do that. I've done that. I've tried many criminal cases where criminal sexual conduct is the issue. Just because they're children doesn't mean they can't be cross-examined. Why are we afraid of that?
But this was not a criminal proceeding, though. That's another key difference here, I think, as well.
It's
establishing that someone committed a sex offense. And keep in mind, if you're just snuggling with your child, which I've done with my daughter, back to back, if the contact is innocent and non-sexual, it's not grounds for an OFP. That was never established here because the judge did not ask those questions.
Thank you. Your time has expired. I've given you some leeway to go over because I know you had more argument to present. Thank